better off. Hello, Mets fans. Welcome to A Pod of Their Own. We are on episode 7, and I am once again joined by my lovely co-hosts, Maggie Wiggin. Hello, Maggie.
Hi, Allison.
And Linda Servich. Hi, Linda.
Hello, Allison.
We are recording this on Tuesday night, May 14th, and the Mets are finally playing baseball again. It feels like it was more than just 2 days, doesn't it?
Well, it's been raining for 40 days and 40 nights, so...
Built a goddamn arc.
Lines up. Yep. Noah.
Noah's Ark.
Got Noah's Ark going. So the Mets are finally playing again as we speak and winning. So that's very exciting. Overall, the Mets are, you know, in a rough position, but not in the roughest position they could be in. They are currently 3.5, 4.5 games out of first. Which one is it? I can't remember.
4.5, I think.
The Phillies are in first place, and the Braves are one game ahead of the Mets. And then the Nationals are far behind the Mets, and the Marlins are in the basement, as we expected. But the Mets have entered sort of an easy stretch of their schedule. They got a series against the Marlins, which they won the first two games. They didn't get a chance to complete the sweep because the game was rained out. And now they're playing the Nationals. And then I believe they will be playing Miami again and the Nationals again. And they will be playing the Detroit Tigers as well. So they're facing an easy part of their schedule. The Mets have had the toughest schedule to this date of any of the National League East teams, I would say, as far as strength of schedule and as far as travel. So they're finally entering an easier stretch of the schedule, whereas the other NL East teams are entering a more difficult part of their schedule, especially the Phillies. So the Mets really kind of have to take advantage of that, don't you guys think?
Yeah, I will say, so it's an easy part of the schedule in terms of the strength of their opponents, but I did realize that they're heading into a 20-day stretch of consecutive games, so that's just going to make things difficult considering that they are running out 50% of a starting rotation.
Yes, that's an issue.
Yes, and Wilmer Font is one of them.
Yeah. I wasn't really counting him.
Okay.
I don't
blame you. Sorry, Wilmer.
Yeah, we...
my Wilmer.
Hashtag not my Wilmer.
Not my Wilmer.
As far as, you know, updates on... Mats and Vargas are concerned. Originally, the plan was for Mats to return this weekend against Miami. And I think that that's still on the table, but Mickey Callaway kind of gave a very non-committal quote about that today. And that's kind of like, oh, Jesus Christ, here we go again. So who knows? Mats is supposed to come back this weekend, maybe a little bit later than that. Vargas, we don't really have a timetable on at all. He's running. That's as far as I know. He has a hamstring strain, so he's running, but he hasn't returned to, like, throwing. He's supposed to throw a bullpen this weekend, I believe, and see how that pans out. So that's kind of where we're at with the pitching, and now we have, as Maggie said, 20 consecutive days without a day off. We had gotten away with it up until now because we had had days off and rainouts that have allowed us to sort of, you know, go without a fifth starter for a while, but that's not going to be the case pretty soon. So not only do we have Wilmer Font in the rotation, we may end up with an Oswalter Flexen thing happening.
Yeah, Wilmer Font is not only in our rotation, he is our number 4 starter.
Super.
It's not what you want.
But
other than, like, the actual starting pitchers that we do, that the Mets do have been very good lately. Yes. I think they're near the top of baseball in, you know, for the month of May in terms of ERA, both on the starting and on the relieving side.
Yeah, as a whole staff.
So that's been a nice recovery because it was definitely a very scary stretch for a while there, and they looked absolutely lost.
Yeah. Well, they only had up to go, so this is, like, I guess, kind of normalizing, and especially Lugo and Gazelman, too. They have been phenomenal coming out of the pen recently.
They've been key. Yeah. Absolutely key.
Enough that I really hope they don't have to pull them, one or both of them, out of the bullpen for the rotation, because you really don't want to lose those weapons.
Yeah.
No, and they can go multiple innings. It's just do you want them going multiple innings at the beginning of the game or the end of the game? That's really what it comes down to.
And the problem with Lugo especially is that since Familia has been on the injured list, Lugo's basically been the eighth inning guy. Yeah. And may continue to be, because who knows, even when Familia does return, if Familia's not, you know, something resembling himself, he's not a good eighth inning guy then he's not your setup man. And Mickey Callaway and others have made, you know, sort of allusions to easing him back into the setup role, which I think is fine, but the problem is then Lugo becomes your setup man, which is fine, but also that means that he only pitches the eighth inning and doesn't pitch multiple innings, which removes one of those multi-inning weapons. Then you only have Gesellman to be your multi-inning, you know, shutdown guy, which
I
is
wouldn't
an issue.
Be shocked though. I mean, if Lugo is, first of all, I think Callaway may be kind of hinting at, you know, when talking about Familia having to kind of work his way back in, I think he may also be kind of hinting at it being Lugo's job to lose. But then also, I think we've seen him use Lugo creatively, and I feel like that pairing, the Callaway-Lugo pairing, is one that could end up with him as kind of being able to approximate a multi-inning setup role. So, like, if there's nothing to worry about in the seventh, and maybe he sits and comes up in the eighth. But if things are looking tight in the seventh, then bring him in and he can give you two basically setup innings. So it's, I don't hate Lugo kind of straddling those two roles. I think it's one that can actually, I think it can work.
I agree. Yeah. And but I Mickey Callaway has to be up to the task. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, like, let's say the Mets are up by three in the eighth, and then they score another run in the ninth, then maybe you leave Lugo in instead of bringing Diaz in when you don't need to, if it's a non-save situation.
Got to double
they're
switch.
Very strict. Yeah, since they're very strict about when and when you can't use Diaz.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, the pitching has turned it around, and especially Jacob deGrom, and that's been great to see. Is it's like, finally I feel like I can, like, exhale, you know? It was just like, I think Linda, you and I have talked about this at great length, is like, Jake starts were just like stressing me out at this point. I was just like, is he bad now? And it would just make me so nervous and sad, and I'm just like so glad I'm past that point of my life, and I hope it never returns.
Yeah, like shielding my eyes watching the game. Like, I was more nervous for his starts than like Vargas starts. I'm like, why yeah. Did we reach this point? And but to his credit, he did say after the last game he was never worried. I was like, well, good, I'm glad you weren't, because no, I totally didn't panic. No,
I grew some new gray hairs, but that's fine.
It's fine. It's all
glad
fine.
You were okay with it, because, you know.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, when a guy like that is pitching so badly, every single pitch, you just expect him to come off the mound holding his arm. Like, that was what I was waiting for every single start. And that is exhausting. That's a lot. That's like 100 pitches equals 100 worries.
Well, and then he did. Then it's like, oh, his elbow's barking. It's like, oh, God, here we go. I knew something was wrong.
But yeah, he seems good. And like, and it's interesting because, you know, I wrote that piece about, you know, is it the juice baseballs affecting DeGrom and Syndergaard, because across the league aces were struggling, and it's looking like, you know, it looks like Chris Sale is back. So it's kind of making me wonder if this is like a league wide trend, in that now that the weather is a little bit warmer, although it's not been warm this week and isn't warm tonight, but like as a general whole, the weather is warming up, and maybe the cold April weather combined with the slick baseballs had something to do with it. And maybe now that the weather is warming up, even though they may give up a few more home runs than they ordinarily would because of the juice baseballs and the warm weather, but as a trade-off, they'll actually be able to control their pitches, which is the more important thing. So I'm hoping that that's part of it.
Yeah, and the good ones adapt too.
Exactly.
Like, you know, Scherzer will figure it out, Jake will figure it out, Sale will figure it out. So if they realize something's not working, they'll, like, you know, they've said Syndergaard's throwing more changeups now. So it seems like if he doesn't trust his slider anymore, he'll go to another pitch that he knows he can get people out with.
Yeah. Very blessed to not be facing Max Scherzer in this series, by the way.
Yes. Oh, God.
Hashtag blessed. But yeah, and the other thing is that, so the pitching has turned it around, and the pitching has looked good for, like, you know, relatively good for, like, over a week now. but the offense was looking, you know, horrendous. It was like the second that the pitching was turning it around, the offense kind of died. But the past, you know, few games, offense seems to be back. But again, it's just a question of is this a function of the strength of the schedule? Is it the fact that we're facing weaker opponents, or is it actual adjustments that the hitters are making? And I mean, it can be both of those things, but, you know, it's just a question of, I hope that it's like permanent adjustments that they can take into the rest of the schedule.
Yeah, and like people were also blaming Todd Frazier. Like, as soon as he came back, the offense went into the crapper. But it's like, if your offense can be derailed by one ball player, how solid was your offense to begin with then?
Right, right.
Well, I do think, like, and I kind of explored this last week, I think it was, when I talked about the offense. And it's not necessarily that, like, Frazier is so bad that he murdered the Mets offense on his own. But that when he came up, Dom Smith went down.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't exactly synchronized, but and then also JD Davis, who has been hitting very well, just started getting many, many, many fewer opportunities. So it wasn't it was more like that you had his very bad bat in there, but that also you were losing some good bats. Now Dom Smith is back, which is great.
Yep.
I mean, I think there's definitely a lot going on in terms of the offense. And what's kind of a little, like, it's a very kind of top-heavy offense all of a sudden,
yeah.
Where early in the season, sure, we were seeing, like, up and down the lineup guys were hitting. But now you've got McNeil and Conforto and Alonso all with OPSs over 900. Awesome. But then everything else, I mean, really the only guy you have hanging out in the middle there is Rosario, who I'm dropping a piece for Amazing Avenue. I'm going to say tomorrow, but that won't mean anything to people listening on Wednesday about Rosario. Cause he's really like hanging in there. But everyone else besides those four is really struggling big time. And that's a hard kind of distribution to survive with, because you really need to cluster some action from your guys who can hit. When you only have 3.5 of those, it's rough.
Yeah, and it's gotten to the point where they moved Rosario up to second in the order for today's game, which is actually a decision I agree with, because why the heck not? Put Rosario up there, because usually at the top of your order you want to have McNeil and Nimmo, either 2-1 or 1-2, whatever order you want to put those two in would be like the ideal situation. But because Nimmo is struggling, they can't keep him at the top of the order right now. They just can't do it. And so as a result, because Rosario is actually hitting, they've moved him up to second in the order. I'm hoping that once the offense begins clicking on all cylinders, Nimmo can go back up to either first or second in the order, and McNeil can either be first or second, depending on where you put Nimmo, and you can slot Rosario back down at the bottom of the order, and then it becomes a much more balanced lineup.
Yeah, and it's hard to even just fit all the pieces together, too, and I guess maybe that's a good problem to have, because I also liked Alonso in the second hole to get him, you know, as many at-bats as possible. So now that he's further down, you know, he might only get, you know, 4 bats instead of maybe 5 on a good night. So, I mean, yeah, you want to have your table setters too, but I liked also Alonso in batting second, and they were doing pretty good with him there for a little while. But now you just kind of have all these pieces. And you have to figure out who's hitting, where they belong, you know, and kind of, and again, this goes to, do you trust Mickey Callaway to figure it out?
Exactly. It kind of goes back to what we talked about last week. Do you trust Mickey Callaway to be the manager to manage all these moving parts? Which kind of is a transition to, you know, the other main topic that's happening right now, which is that we had been talking about, you know, leading up to Jed Lowry's return, how would you manage the playing time for all these dudes? Who would you send down for him or cut? As the case may be, and how would you manage the playing time? Who would, like, get days off on certain days? How would you manage the batting order? But now it seems that Jed Lowry has had a setback. Womp womp. Very Mets.
More like a Mets back.
A Mets back.
Yeah, Mets back.
The Mets month is back, baby.
Oh, poor Lowry. I do feel bad for him because it seems like, and he had a good day on Friday. I think he went like 3 for 4 with like a home run and a double. So I was like, this is great. He seems, you know, to be finding his swing. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, he disappeared. We're not sure what's going on. And now he had a setback.
Yeah, it was kind of like...
This is what we knew we were getting with Lowry, is that when he's healthy, he's good. When he's healthy. And I'd like to imagine that maybe he's getting all of his IL time out of the way early, and then his good time will be forevermore. But this was always what you had to watch out for with Lowry, because he's definitely been beat up.
Well, yeah. He did have some freakish injuries earlier in his career, like getting hit in the face with a ball. I think that's what deviated his septum and stuff.
Yeah, so but lately, he's been pretty healthy the past, few years. But yeah, I mean, this is the risk you take when you sign older players, as the Mets are wont to do. But, like, you know, there's a lot of, like, revisionist history for people who are like, see, shouldn't have signed Lowry. I still think it was like a good process thing, and that this is just an unfortunate, you know, bad case of Mets. You know, the second a dude comes to the Mets, he, you know, is hurt all the time as usual. But you know, it's hard to deny that while you can say it was good process, it's hard to deny that Brody Van Wagenen's, you know, off-season free agent acquisitions have looked pretty terrible on the whole, just as the results have been really bad on all fronts, regardless of what you think of the process. You've got Lowry hasn't played a single game yet. You've got Familia, who's been on the injured list and was underperforming before that. You've got Justin Wilson, who was pretty good when he was healthy, but again, on the injured list. And then you've got Wilson Ramos, today's Grand Slam aside, hooray, who has been, you know, pretty bad. He started out really hot with the bat the first few weeks, 2 to 3 weeks of the season, and then was just, you know, big nothing after that until this Grand Slam he just hit. So it's
His hot start was also like, that was a BABIP-y.
Yeah, very bad at ball
slugging. Like,
driven.
And he's not a guy who's gonna hold up like a 400 BABIP at all.
Nope.
No.
So it was always a bit of a nail biter, and you gotta look at kind of what he was looking like last year in terms of the power numbers, and it's a little disconcerting that it's continuing so strongly right now.
Right. So it's kind of like, you know, the offseason acquisitions not looking so hot. It's unfortunate. Wait. But
so is JD Davis his best offseason acquisition?
And Diaz.
Diaz and Cano. Yeah.
I would say Diaz. But that was a trade. I was talking, I said free agent signings.
Okay.
But yeah, acquisitions as a whole, I would say, I mean, I think, you know, jury is still out on, I guess, if I'm being generous, jury's still out on the Cano Diaz trade. It's hard to like evaluate it until Kelenic takes a major league at bat. I think that people like, you know, losing their goddamn minds over Kelenic's minor league stats need to like chill the hell out a little bit.
And honestly, if Diaz is saving postseason games and Cano is hitting in postseason games, it does not matter what Kelenic does in 3 years or 5 years or like it. That's, you know, it doesn't matter that that Michael Fulmer a couple years down the line was throwing really well for the Tigers, because Yoenis Cespedes got the Mets into the playoffs and through the playoffs. That's a successful trade. Like, I don't really need Kelenic to stink it up for this to be a good trade. I just have to see Diaz and Cano doing what they were brought here to do. And half of that so far has worked it out. It's just getting everything else aligned is taking its time.
Yeah, sometimes trades work out for both teams. Like, that's the point of a trade. Not, I need to fleece you in order for this trade to be a good trade.
Exactly.
No, like, the other teams have scouts too. They don't want your crap.
Exactly. So, gotta give something to get something.
Yeah, so if you're going to give up one of the best closers, if not the best closer last year, you're going to have to give up something.
Right. And I mean, you know, it's a win now trade, so I would like for, you know, I think the jury's still out because I would like to see the Mets, you know, win. And so I would like to see them, you know, go to the postseason on the strength of this team partially built by this trade. Because if you're going to trade away prospects, you want to be pretty confident in your team's ability to win now. And obviously the jury is still out on that. But I think on paper, that's still, you know, the acquisitions that he got via that trade have performed very well in Diaz and, you know, pretty well in Cano. And I think that he's going to heat up and be more himself. We've already seen indications of that. And JD Davis, you know, I was actually disappointed in that trade when it happened, but I'll fully take my lumps and admit I was wrong. He's been a good contributor so far for this team.
Yeah, defense aside, but he does seem he hits the ball hard every seems like every time. He was doing fine too. I think they stuck him in the two hole for a little while too, and he was okay. He was holding his own at the top of the lineup. He brings some pop with the bat, so I think he's a solid piece that, you know, winning ball clubs should have on their team.
Yeah, and people are frustrated, and understandably so, with the fact that Frazier coming back cut into his playing time. But I think Frazier started every day for a little while, and I think that Callaway like saw that he like really can't do this anymore. And then Davis started
to
play.
He's batting eighth now.
Yeah, Davis started playing a lot more. Like last week, Davis had more at bats than Frazier had. So he realized, he still hasn't completely benched Frazier. I mean, Frazier's in the starting lineup tonight, but he's at least giving it more of a timeshare than, you know, Frazier's the starting third baseman every single day. Davis is on the bench. He's clearly, at least the message has gotten through to him a little bit. So that's good news. And hopefully it'll continue to be that, or Frazier will, you know, start hitting and maybe he'll play more if he starts hitting, you know. So that'd be good. Point being, the Mets can survive without Jed Lowry. It just would be nice if they didn't have to.
Yeah. Although, you know, it also would make Callaway think about his lineups and stuff, and Callaway thinking can sometimes be dangerous.
Right.
Especially with his pregame press conference today about
he said
Wilson.
Some really dumb stuff.
Yeah.
About how, like, citing the Mets record when Wilson Ramos starts. And, of course, Ramos hits a grand slam, so he's going to, like, feel like he's a genius now.
Uh-huh.
Like, see? Wilson Ramos is awesome.
He's our
catcher ERA isn't a thing, and it isn't, then catcher wins is definitely not a thing.
Even more not a thing.
Yeah, Mickey.
Like, oh, my God. Anyway, hopefully the Mets, you know, really continue to take advantage of this part in the schedule, get their pitching continues to stay straightened out, and hopefully they can cobble together the back end of the rotation while we wait for Mats and Vargas to come back. And hopefully the offense can continue to capitalize on, you know, this part of the schedule. When we get back, we will follow up somewhat on our segment from last week and talk about developments that have happened since then on Russell, Osuna, and others. So stay tuned for that.
Beyonce, Ariana Grande, and Drake are talked about ad nauseum as celebrities, but there's one thing that's rarely discussed, their music.
On Switched on Pop, we go deep into the sounds of pop music to explain what it means, how it's made, and why it's so effective.
We talk with some of today's greatest artists, producers, and journalists to decode the musical logic behind our modern soundtrack and understand its role in our culture.
Switched on Pop will reveal for you how a secretive Swedish producer is behind many of the top 10 hits of the past 20 years.
And we'll uncover the ways that songwriters embed their political activism into today's most popular tracks.
We'll show you the surprising musical similarities between Cardi B and Taylor Swift.
And we'll even dive into the classical past to hear how the Jonas Brothers mirror Mozart's youthful party days.
I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
Join us on a journey through the world of popular music by subscribing to Switched on Pop on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app to get new episodes every Tuesday.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Just a heads up, a content warning, similar to last week, we will be discussing domestic violence during this segment. If this is something that hits close to home for you or something you'd rather not listen to, skip ahead about 25 minutes. You will be able to find the official timestamps of when each segment begins on AmazingAvenue.com or the show post for this episode. Thanks. And here's the segment. And we are back. So this week, we're going to sort of do a follow-up on last week's segment, which we didn't exactly, like, necessarily plan on doing, but we feel like we have to do it because a lot happened since we recorded last Tuesday. Addison Russell was activated onto the Cubs active roster literally the day after we recorded our podcast. And he gave a rather shitty quote. Which do one of you have it? Do you want one of you want to read it, or should I read it? It's pretty bad.
I don't. You can go ahead and read it.
All right, I'll read it. So he said, quote, "I'm a baseball player for the Chicago Cubs. I'm one of the dudes in this clubhouse. I'm one of the guys who goes out there and puts their body on the line. We do it because we love it. We want to win, and we want to bring another championship to Chicago. And if hometown fans want to boo someone that's trying to help bring the team a World Series, then that's on them."
Like, there's just so much wrong with that statement. I don't even know where to begin. Putting your body on the line, number one, is horrible.
That's not a. That's also not a visual that he really ought to be invoking.
That's what, like, I'm saying. Exactly. Yeah, like,
it's like extra, like, yikes.
Yeah, like, use your brain before you speak. And then clearly he was expecting to be cheered too, to for him to have that reaction to being booed, because before the game he was like, oh, you know, however the field fans feel, that's fine, you know. But then after the game, he's like, ah, that's on them. So clearly he did not get the reaction he was expecting and then got mad about it. But, you know,
and like, I mean, why wouldn't he expect to be cheered? Everyone else has gotten cheered. Uh-huh. Like,
and he got
cheered
in the minors.
If anything, this is like a small step forward for humanity. But like, this feeds into the expectation that the media and his peers help create, that when you do something bad in your life, you can fix it with baseball. And that's not how it works. Like, you can't make up for hurting a person by hitting a baseball. That's not, those are not equivalent situations.
Yeah, and like, why don't you love
this
me?
This is what he thinks. This is what he thinks will happen. This is how he thinks it works. Because everybody has been telling him and everyone else that this is how it works. So I mean, don't get me wrong, he's trash, but also I can see why he expected something different.
Yeah, fans, yeah. Why don't you love me? I'm trying to bring a World Series back to the Chicago Cubs. Like, why, like, how could you possibly
do that? The most important. Yeah. Like, well, and then there was that stupid article that I found beforehand, where they were asking if he had more joy for the game and if more passion for the game. Like, that's not what we're concerned about right now.
That was the Nightingale article, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was Bastion, Jordan Bastion.
Oh God, there were two awful softball pieces about him in the space of like 3 days. Just like, how could we love you more, Addison Russell?
Yeah, like, oh, you're passion for the game has grown because you almost lost it because you beat your pregnant girlfriend. Like, how does that make you appreciate the game more? That shouldn't follow logically.
It's like they double and triple and quadruple down on this tone deaf stuff.
Yes. And like, of course it was a man asking the questions too.
Right. Of course. And it's like, and not only did all of this occur, we learned today that the Cubs, quote, internally, end quote, want to move Javier Baez around the infield and make Addison Russell the everyday shortstop. So not only is he A, indignant about the fans booing him, completely defensive about the whole thing, doesn't understand how they couldn't like him, clearly, again, does not remotely comprehend or take responsibility for his actions, B, getting softball questions from the media, more fluff pieces on and on, C, he's literally, like, supplanting a superior player at his position. Like, yeah, what, like, is
an MVP
happening?
Caliber player. Why are you bending over backwards to get this guy at bats, getting him comfortable? I guess he doesn't like second base. Who cares? Like, you don't like second base, you're off the team. I don't care. Like Javi Baez got MVP votes last year. We should care about what Javi Baez wants.
It's mind-boggling. Like, I mean, on one hand, like, it's mind-boggling. On the other hand, I'm not surprised at all. Sadly.
No.
Like, this is just, like, unbelievable stuff. And, you know, so Russell is not the only one to be completely tone-deaf this week. We also have Roberto Osuna, who we also mentioned on last week's podcast. He made a very special tweet. On Mother's Day. You know, so add compounding the tone deafness of the whole thing. He tweeted this on Mother's Day. So he tweeted a picture of his pink cleats that he was wearing on Mother's Day. You know, lots of players have pink cleats on Mother's Day. So he was one of the many players. So he tweeted, and the real issue with the tweet was the caption, which was he wrote it in Spanish, but I'm going to read the caption in English, which is "for my mom and also for all my haters."
With smiley faces
and dollar signs.
And dollar sign emojis.
Which is like,
I don't know what that is all about. But yeah. But again, it comes down to this, like, it's this, like, oh, you don't like me, ha ha, kind of.
Haters thing, which, gonna hate.
Which, right, I mean, it's that attitude is fine when it's coming from, like, Bryce Harper,
right?
When
exactly.
People really do just hate him because he's got an attitude, because he beats up on our teams and whatever,
because,
like,
he's good at the sports.
Yeah,
like, and in an annoying way. I mean, yeah, Bryce Harper has haters. Robert Osuna does not have haters. He has people who are legitimately outraged by the terrible things he has done, and the fact that they persist. He and Russell both persist in being completely incapable of drawing this distinction. I don't know if it's just that they're not very bright or that they're sociopaths or maybe both of these things, but it's not good.
But why wouldn't you? Because you got away with it. And he profited off his domestic abuse. If he had never beat his wife, he would probably still be on the last or close to last place Toronto Blue Jays. Now he's on a perennial team that could win the World Series every year. So you know what? He actually came out ahead in that situation. So of course he's not going to care about, you know, what people think. He got away with it and he's in a better position because of it. And you know what? And nobody in baseball seems to care. You know, there's that quote in Titanic where Rose says, "I feel like I'm in the middle of a crowded room screaming at the top of my lungs and nobody even looks up." And that's what it feels like. Yeah. Like, it just seems like nothing happens and nobody cares when it does happen.
Right. And it's ridiculous. Yeah. For all my haters.
Yeah, for my haters. Yeah, for my haters. We hate you because you beat your wife or your girlfriend. Like, the nerve of us.
Like Maggie said, trying to equate, like, sports hate, like, good-natured sports hate, like the type that Mets fans have for Bryce Harper, where, like, you know, we hate him because he's good at baseball and good against our team and has, like, attitude and swagger or whatever, you know, and, like, we look at his face and we're like, Bryce Harper. Like, that is sports hate. I don't hate him as a person because he hasn't done anything like this to my knowledge. And so, like, obviously as a person, he's fine. But, like, these people have done legitimately terrible things. They are trash human beings. This isn't just sports hate. This is, like, your fan base telling you that they are very upset and offended that they are on, that you are on their baseball team and still in this game that they love. This is completely different. And they just, that completely goes over their head. They don't get it at all. It's like,
and if these players and their defenders want to then make the claim of like, oh, well, everybody deserves a second chance. You know, let them prove that they've changed. Well, here's your chance, and you keep proving the opposite. Like, keep your head down. Say that you're grateful to have an opportunity at all, and you're going to just do everything you can to show that you are a better person. Like, that's all you say. And then you shut up. You don't actually ever do the bad thing again. You thank your lucky stars that you get paid millions of dollars to do the thing that you love, and you live your life quietly. That's how you do it.
Right. And if you're Addison Russell, you say the same thing that you had been saying before all the booze rained down on you. You say, you know, I've got to earn the trust of the fans back. I understand why some of them may feel this way. That's all you have to say.
And I know all you have to say. I know we put David Wright on a pedestal here, but why is he the only one who has ever said what Jose did was wrong? He's the only person who has ever specifically called out a teammate saying what they did was wrong and it should never happen again. Why can't any of these other guys say that? Like, why can't we all agree that domestic violence is wrong? Why does that even need to be said? And yet I do need them to say that, because their actions tell me that they don't believe it.
And it's not like Jose Reyes ditched David Wright as a friend after he said that. Like, they clearly remained friends. So it's possible, you know? Like, it's possible to have, you know, to sort of compartmentalize, you know, your friendship with this guy who you clearly have built a relationship with over many, many years of playing together, and I respect that, with this terrible freaking thing he did and still condemning that. And not having to even lose the friendship out of it. He said what he did was awful, and he didn't mince words about it. What he did was awful. No. I hope he learns from it. That's all you have to say. And they stayed friends.
Yeah, and there was no reports of like clubhouse issues or, you know, like
there was no backlash.
It is possible to, like we said, it is possible to call your friend out when they do something horrible, and nobody else. Not a single person in the entire MLB has the guts to do it.
Nope.
And now there's a whole new team who we can look forward to not doing anything about it, because we have a new announcement just this morning.
Julio Urias on the LA Dodgers this morning. He is a, you know, kind of a prospect still-ish young player who's in their bullpen right now.
I think he's 22.
22 years old. And he, you know, was arrested this morning. Well, last night, rather, but we learned of it this morning. He was arrested after arguing in the parking lot of, like, I think a shopping mall. He was arguing with the woman he was with, unclear if it's his girlfriend or not, but arguing with the woman he was with at a shopping mall. And apparently there are witness accounts and videotape of him shoving her to the ground. So he has been placed on administrative leave by the Dodgers, and he spent the night in jail and was bailed out early this morning. So that is the latest. We have yet another player. This keeps on happening. And until we, you know, respond appropriately to this, people are going to keep doing this and think it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to get away with it.
Yeah, well, this is also another illustration of something that's really common to see in domestic violence cases, where apparently the woman who he shoved to the ground when the police showed up, she said that it was just a fight, that nothing happened, that it didn't get physical. Now, of course, there are multiple witnesses who have no reason to invent this action on his part, but it's just going to make things complicated, and people are going to say, well, if he's abusing her, then why did she stay? Why did she defend him? And I'm just going to keep sending everybody to the websites we've been sharing for the last week, because there are so, so many reasons why she might not feel safe to actually press charges, to tell the truth about what happened. It's so sad to see, and it's so difficult.
Yeah, because imagine if you're in her position and you get in an argument at a shopping mall, at a shopping mall in public, and he does this to you in public in front of other people. Imagine if he perceives that you've ruined his career, what he will do to you in private for going to the cops, for, you know, going to the team, for going to whomever about it. And rather than trying to say, no, 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 wasn't that big of a deal, you know, don't worry. So, you know, I don't want this to be a thing.
Yeah.
There are complicated reasons why women don't want to come forward about this stuff. But there are multiple eyewitness accounts. Like Maggie said, there's no reason for them to lie. And the article, the initial, it was reported initially by TMZ and then obviously taken up by many other outlets. But in the TMZ article, the article even used the word adamant. Witnesses were adamant that they saw Arias push the woman to the ground. So, you know, it's not just that the witnesses were saying, oh, yeah, we think this is what happened. They seem pretty, you know, sure that that's what happened. So we'll see what happens there. Like I said, he's been placed on administrative leave. Obviously, you know, this is a different organization. You know, the Houston Astros claimed they had a no tolerance policy, but then they brought on Osuna anyway. So we've already seen how teams can be hypocritical about this and say one thing and do another when it's your guy that's under fire. But, you know, the Dodgers don't have the best track record in the world with dealing with this stuff. There was, you know, a previous incident involving the Dodgers, involving now Phillies manager Gabe Kapler, among others, where there was an incident where underage girls were partying with some of their minor league players in a hotel room. And a girl was physically assaulted by the two other women in the room. And then later alleged that there was a sexual assault that occurred by one of the Dodgers minor league players. And the Dodgers never went to the police. And, you know, kind of try, Gabe Kapler tried to arrange a dinner with the girl and her grandmother to try to kind of like sweep the whole thing under the rug. Now, Gabe Kapler, you know, trying to be fair here, Gabe Kapler says he was, when he was organizing the dinner, he wasn't aware that there was that a sexual assault had apparently occurred. He found that out later, but still no one ever went to the police.
Well, and I think, like, so this is also a story, you know, asterisks abound, where this is coming from a very limited set of sources, so a lot of this is alleged, and there's certainly a lot of conflicting accounts of what actually happened. But one thing that doesn't seem to be in question is that the Dodgers didn't share this incident with MLB, and that Kapler was a big part of why, or at least, you know, he certainly was in a position to report this to MLB to allow for a league-wide disciplinary approach, but they opted to keep it in-house, which is very sketchy and certainly not just not what you want, and it raises some pretty serious trust issues with the Dodgers organization in particular.
Like, it also, you know, makes you wonder, you know, if there was some of their higher prospects, it does, like, you know, like, you kind of go, like, did the Dodgers benefit by not telling anyone about this? Because minor leaguers are subject to the same domestic violence policy, I believe, because the Astros, one of their minor leaguers, was suspended. So it does make you question it, but yeah, there, we don't know the full story. We'll probably never know the full story, but you're not willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, per se.
Yeah. So, yeah, this organization and MLB has, you know, a bad history when it comes to these things. And, you know, it's not just domestic violence. There are other players, like a whole host of other players that have done terrible things, that are, you know, making their way into baseball and quietly playing baseball, and nothing's really being done about it. So, you know, there is Jung Ho Gong, who, you know, has three DUIs,
oh my God,
and a sexual assault charge, allegation, I'll put it that way, no charges, allegation.
He just quietly just like magically appeared on the Pirates roster at the start of the season. Like there was very little media attention paid to the fact that this criminal just pops back in, is playing like nothing changed.
Right. He played in the KBO for a while, if I recall correctly, after all these things went down. He was playing in Korea for a while, and now he's back in baseball, and no one cares. He's got three DUIs. There is an allegation that was never really resolved, that a woman says that they connected on a dating app. He invited her up to his hotel room. She went up to his hotel room. He gave her a drink, and she alleges that he assaulted her, either putting something in the drink or giving her too many drinks, but she was in and out of consciousness, and he sexually assaulted her. So that, you know, and three DUIs, and he's just casually playing baseball, and no one is saying anything about it. Like, you know, at least, even if they're fluff pieces, at least Addison Russell's being written about. This is not being written about by barely anyone. It just, like, sort of happened without much fanfare. No one said anything. He's just playing again.
Well, I guess because he figures enough time has gone, like you said, he did play in Korea for a little while, so I guess people figure enough time leaves, nobody cares, you just let it slide. And, you know, sadly, that's what does happen. People forget, and then they just, the whole issue just kind of gets swept under the rug, and that's that. And so you do have to stay on top of these things.
Exactly. Like, we can't let these things drop, because in, you know, bringing up another player, we have Luke Heimlich, who was a former college star at Oregon State, you know, was eligible for the MLB draft during the most recent draft. But he pled guilty to sexually molesting his 6-year-old niece when he was 15. Now, he claims that he is not actually guilty of this and made the guilty plea to protect his family. You know, obviously, it's another case where we may never know the real truth here. But the reality is, in this case, that he actually pled guilty, which is more than most of these players. Most of these players, these are just allegations, and they're never actually, you know, charged with crimes. In this case, this is an actual crime that he pled guilty to.
Well, and a lot of people will point to, it's certainly far from unheard of for people to plead guilty to crimes that they haven't done.
Sure.
But the scenarios in which that occurs is so very different from this situation. And it's frequently, you know, young men in poverty and with criminal histories, often other crimes in their background, poverty, men of color who are not known for getting a fair shake in the justice system, and their crimes like robbery and assault, and it's a totally different thing for this, I guess I'll call him a boy, I mean he was 16 I believe when this happened, for him with a like stable family situation, white middle class, you know, he can afford a lawyer. This is not all, you know, with a public defender is 23 minutes to decide to plead guilty to a crime of this magnitude. It's just a totally, they're not comparable situations. So to point to a well-known problem in the justice system for a very specific population and to assign it to this, it is not, they're just not equatable. So just putting that out there.
Sure. And I mean, you know, again, we'll never know the full story, probably. And it's possible he did not commit this crime and he was actually protecting his family. But if that is the case, then, you know, you assume all the consequences that come with that. If you have to make that cost benefit analysis, if you've decided that you are going to plead guilty to this crime. And again, this is separate from the justice system preying on, you know, certain groups. You have to accept what you have pled to. And that should involve not playing professional baseball ever again. But he did go undrafted. at the time. People were worried that he would be drafted to, you know, by a Major League Baseball team regardless of this.
And the Royals were interested.
Really going for it.
Yeah, we thought they might. They did not. No one drafted him. He went undrafted. However, he did sign a deal with a team in Liga Mexicana in Mexico, a professional team. And he, it was unclear whether he would be, you know, permitted to play for them at first, but because the president of Mexico, you know, said maybe we're not going to let him play, but, you know, but he did, you know, he is playing for them. As far as I know, in April, he was set to make his debut for them. So, and, you know, this is kind of one of those things where it sets the, it lays the ground for him potentially coming into baseball through the back door and no one making a stink about it, which we should make.
Which just means we have to make a stink every time. Every time the Royals are like, well, that's just what you have to do is let them know we're paying attention.
Yeah. And the Royals taking the whole year the now attitude, like you can't watch porn in the clubhouse, but sexually assaulting a 6-year-old is okay. Like, you can't choose your morals that way.
Right. It's, yeah, it would be pretty ironic in the worst way if the Royals were ultimately the team to sign him. But, you know, these are just things that, you know, happen that go under the radar because not enough people are talking about it, and we just need to keep talking about it. So, you know, we on this podcast are not going to stop talking about it, and you shouldn't either. Because if we stop talking about it, we allow these things to happen. Because it sends the message that this stuff is okay. And we need to tell the world that it's not okay that this stuff is happening. So that is our update on last week's episode. We are going to take another break. And when we get back, we're going to finish up this week's episode with answering some of your emails. And then, of course, with walk-off wins as always. So stay tuned for that.
Hey everybody, I'm Neil I. Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and this is The Vergecast. Vergecast is the flagship podcast of The Verge. Every week we cover the latest in tech news and reviews. We take a critical look at what is going on now and next in the world of tech. The show is hosted by me, our executive editor Dieter Bohn.
Not your friend.
And Paul Miller.
It just feels like there's something wrong with all computers though, don't you think that sometimes?
We do that on Fridays, and on Tuesdays we have an interview episode. I've been talking to all kinds of influential people in and around the world of tech. We talked to Microsoft founder Bill Gates about his philanthropic efforts.
You can design systems without having to reveal any individual's particular medical record.
Journalists and academics like Lina Khan, who thinks that we should be doing way more to break up giant companies like Amazon and Facebook.
I think in hindsight, allowing Facebook to buy up both WhatsApp and Instagram proved to have been the wrong call.
And we talked to tech CEOs like Vizio's Bill Baxter, who explained exactly how smart TV manufacturers make their money.
It's about post-purchase monetization of the TV.
It's ads.
Check us out every Friday to hear about everything in tech, from new iPhone leaks to breaking down Facebook's ongoing issues of privacy to just me and Paul ranting at each other about the role of the government. And check us out on Tuesdays when I host the interview episode. Subscribe to The Vergecast wherever podcasts are served. We'll see you then.
I'm Todd Vanderwerf, the host of Primetime, a new show from Vox.com. This season, we're tackling the American presidency on TV. Stories that capture the way television affects and reflects politics and culture. We'll take a look at fictional presidents who've changed the way we think about the real Oval Office.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good morning, everyone. Please, take your seats.
And how real presidents use TV to further their own goals.
What did you come here to plug?
Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
From the first TV president...
People have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
To arguably the last.
We are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
Primetime, from the Vox Media Podcast Network and Vox.com. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, and we are back. We are going to do what we call the seventh inning stretch, which is when we answer your emails. We haven't done that in a few weeks, so we're going to answer some emails that we've gotten. So our first email is from Ryan Carney. Thanks, Ryan, for writing in. So generally, I'm not going to read the whole email, but generally he thinks that we were, you know, we've been too tough on Jason Vargas and he's not really the problem with the pitching and we've got other problems that are more important than Jason Vargas. And he writes in part, and I quote, "If we get five decent innings out of our fifth starter, especially with the supposed quality of our other four starters, we should be happy. I don't know how long Vargas will continue his run of non-abysmal starts, but he's not the problem. In fact, his ERA in games he starts is only 4.18 this year, if you take out the relief inning. His second half last year wasn't awful. First impressions matter a lot, and his first impression with the 2018 Mets was horrific. And also his almost first impression this year, as the back-to-back debacles of pitching in relief and then not getting out of the first inning was pretty blood-curdling. I'm not a Vargas apologist. I think he should be on a very short leash. As someone who lives near D.C. and saw him pitch a lot, I really wanted them to sign Gio Gonzalez. But the Mets' lack of pitching this year has not been a Vargas problem." So I think that that's a fair point, Ryan. I agree with you. I think that, you know, a lot of people are really tough on Vargas, and, you know, he's done okay since, you know, his early struggles. Obviously, he's on the injured list right now, but he did put together a string of okay starts. My one quibble that I'll take with what Ryan said is he said at the beginning, if we get five decent innings out of our fifth starter, Vargas hasn't been even been going five is the issue. Like, he's basically like four and a third, 4 2/3. Like, if we can get five decent innings out of Vargas, that's good. He's only pitched in the sixth inning, if I think, a single time this season. And most of the time he's not even pitching in the fifth inning. So, you know, that's kind of the real problem, not just the quality of his pitching, but the fact that he's not even going five innings.
Well, and didn't they sign him as like an innings guy?
Innings like, eater, and he, they called him.
Yes.
You know?
Like, yeah, and he's been the complete opposite of that. So, I mean, yeah, as a fifth starter, I guess you can get by with that, but the issue is then it starts snowballing. Like, now, when you also have, I know Vargas is also hurt, but let's say Matt still can't go, and then you have Wilmer Font and Jason Vargas in your rotation, that's when the issue pops up. Not just Jason Vargas, it's what's beyond him, too, and can you afford having, you know, two wasted days almost?
Well, I do appreciate Ryan pointing out that they still should have signed Gio because that's, you know, it's not that Jason Vargas is the worst pitcher on the planet. It's just that there are better options that build a better roster. And I think that's what I think that sometimes gets translated as Jason Vargas is the worst pitcher on the planet, but he's not. It's
no,
that is a fair point. The Mets still need to sign or acquire at this point of the year. Who even knows what's going to happen? They need more pitching. Everyone needs more pitching, but the Mets definitely need more pitching.
Yeah,
yeah. That's still the heart of the matter is the depth. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, and we can't afford, you know, we can't afford a pitcher that's a supposed innings eater only going 4 1/3 innings when our depth is so thin. That's the problem, because then our bullpen gets taxed. Then we get bullpen injuries, which we already have, and then it domino effects on the whole thing. So it's not necessarily that Vargas has been the problem from the perspective of his ERA. It's not that, you know, he's not getting bombed every night, which is good. That's great. And I'm happy, and I'll fully take that from Vargas, you know. My Vargas bar is pretty low at this point, and I will fully take what he has put together so far. But the problem is the lack of length that we're getting from him and how that's taxing the bullpen, and we already have such thin depth. If we had more depth behind him and were able to cycle more guys up from AAA that were actually effective, then, you know, it would be less of a problem. But it has a domino effect, and it's been a real problem, and we've seen it already. So we will move on to our other email from Steve McGowan. He's actually sent us two emails, which is really, really great. He sent us an email saying that he is listening all the way from Alberta, Canada, and he really enjoys the show, which is so great to hear. So thank you, Steve. We've already had, like, emails from many countries, which is so great. That's, like, really cool to hear that people are tuning in, not just in the U.S., but in Canada and across the pond in Europe, which is really, really cool. Really glad to see it. He also sent a message to us saying that he really enjoyed the most recent show about domestic violence the most. And he said in part, and I quote, I would reiterate that having fans like you matter to the sport. You continue to enrich the game by your dedication to the game and your willingness to produce a podcast that gives us Mets fans everywhere the opportunity to hear your voices and learn from you. So that's really sweet. Thank you so much, Steve. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, that's and awesome.
I would say in general, we got really, really inspiring feedback on our last episode about domestic violence in a similar vein to what Steve sent, although Steve certainly like was extremely touching with how he phrased it. But that was really, it felt really good putting kind of our souls out there last week and feeling that, you know, people were really hearing what we were saying.
Yeah, that helps a lot. And having support helps a lot, too. Like, in, like, every aspect, just support women, because it did take a toll. It was very hard to do that last week.
Yeah, it's emotionally taxing to not only, like, see these things on your timeline all the time and have to mm-hmm. react to them and then have to talk about it again and feel it again and again. But it's you know, it's worth it to us because, you know, we're going to keep talking about these things, even though it hurts, because it's worth it to keep sending this message out there. And, you know, we think it's important that you guys hear this from women, from female sports fans, from female baseball fans. So thank you so much for all of your dedication and support for the show. We really, really appreciate it. And we're deeply grateful. So our last submission, it's not an email, it's actually a Twitter message that we got. So our last submission is, hey, question for the pod. What are your Mets origin stories for each of you? How did you guys each end up Mets fans? So I think we talked briefly about our origin stories in the very first pod. Linda, what is your Mets origin story?
Okay, well, my dad and my uncle had season's tickets to Shea behind in the orange seats behind home plate when growing up. And I don't remember much about the games, the players, anything. I just remember walking up that tunnel and seeing the greenest grass and the bright seats. And the stadium kind of unfold in front of you at Shea. And, you know, that was awe-inspiring to a kid, you know, just the excitement you got and just, you know, the wonder of it all, just walking into Shea Stadium as a kid. And, you know, baseball was kind of in my blood because my dad was a Mets fan. My mom is from Philly. She's a Phillies fan. So that's been kind of hard. But especially, you know, back in 2007, but we won't talk about that. And then, you know, so I don't really, you know, that's kind of stuck with me as, you know, those memories as a kid. But I made the choice to be a Met fan in 1999. I grew to love that team. I fell in love with Robin Ventura and Mike Piazza. And I both love them and hate them for that because now they've doomed me to a life of being a Met fan. Yeah. And, you know, that was my first real experience of sports heartbreak that, you know, but it was also, you know, it was everything that season. It was like, you know, the high of the walk-off, the Grand Slam single, and then the lowest low the next day. And so, like, that's what baseball is. You know, you go with the highs and you go with the lows, and, you know, it still goes on. You know, the players have changed, but, you know, I still love the team. I still, you know, there's always somebody else to root for. Piazza's gone, but then David Wright came, and now Wright's gone, but I love Jacob deGrom. So it's like, you know, it's just, you know, it's the same story, just different chapters that you get to read. And, you know, and that's what I find exciting. And, you know, it hasn't been the best, you know, they haven't been the best in my life, but, you know, I still made the right choice.
Yeah. So Maggie, how about you? What's your Mets origin story?
Mine is all genetic. My mom was a Mets fan. Her dad was a Mets fan. And I don't know, I mean, I just, I grew up really loving going to games, even though they always lost. I recently told, a couple years ago, I told my mom, I was like, I don't think they ever won when we went when I was a kid. And she's like, no, they definitely won. I was like, okay, name a win.
Name one like, time.
Any win that we saw in person. And she could not come up with anything. So I'm going to take that as a nod to my being right that I never saw them win. But I loved going to games and being at games. I really fell away from it in high school and college because I was just in a very different kind of social scene. You know, I went to Sarah Lawrence. We didn't have sports or people who like sports. So it just like wasn't really a part of my life. But as soon as I graduated and I moved into the city, like it just, I fell right into it. Like I had never stopped. So that's my origin story.
It's always nice how you like how baseball is like such a constant like that, mm-hmm. you know, like you can drift away for a couple of years because you have like different life circumstances that like take you away from the team for whatever reason. But like you can come back and it's like nothing ever changed. It's like your best friend, you know, like how you can go like months without speaking to your best friend. But then if you hang out, then it's like nothing ever changed. And that's like such a good thing about baseball for me, too. And I feel that. So my origin story is mostly genetic too. My dad is a hardcore Mets fan. So he's pretty much the reason why I'm a Mets fan. I actually do come from a divided family though. My mom's side of the family is from the Bronx, so they are Yankees fans, and my dad's side of the family are Mets fans with a couple of exceptions. One branch of my dad's side of the family are also Yankees fans. So, it's like kind of, I would say like a 65-35 split with the 65% being Mets fans. They kind of, growing up, the Yankees side of the family and the Mets side of the family kind of like competed for my affections a little bit. But the Mets side ultimately won out, and it was kind of an uphill battle for the Yankees side because my mom, even though she really, really enjoys going to games with my dad and I, she wasn't passionate enough about the Yankees to fight back. Really? And she kind of just succumbed to Mets fandom when she married my dad. And so it kind of became like my grandparents versus my dad, my Yankees fan grandparents. But the Mets ultimately won out. And I would say like my earliest memories, I remember the 99 team, but only very vaguely. And I would say I have much sharper memories of the 2000 team because that's kind of when the fight for my affections kind of came to a head, I feel like. Even though the Mets came out on the losing side of that World Series, that's kind of like the first like team, the first Mets team I acutely remember is that team. And then I feel like I kind of started going over to the Mets side during that time just because I fell in love with those players on that team, like Linda said, Piazza, like Edgardo Alfonso especially. Yeah. He was my favorite back then. But I feel like my Mets fandom was really like cemented, I'll say, with the post 9/11 home run from Mike Piazza.
Yeah.
Like that's like the moment when I can remember just like falling in love with the game. Like that just, you know, being a kid, I was 11. So I was like, you know, like old enough to understand what was happening, but still young enough that like this kind of broke my childhood a little bit. Like you kind of lose a piece of your childhood that you never get back. Like when something like that happens, and like the post 9/11 world was a completely different place for me than the pre 9/11 world as a child. And so, you know, when you go through something like that as a kid and you're trying to process it all as an 11-year-old, it's really difficult. And like I just remember like Mike making me feel okay again, and that was like a big thing with my Mets fandom. It was kind of like that was the turning point where it was like, all right, no going back now. Like I'm a Mets fan forever now. There's like no. So I like, you know, early on when the Mets were good in 99 and 2000, those were kind of my like I like baseball years, like realizing that I like was enjoying the game and I really liked baseball. But like that 2001 home run was really like, I'm a Mets fan forever and I'm never letting this go. And like Maggie said, like in high school, I was a rabid Mets fan the whole time. Like the 06 team was during my high school years. So that was like a big, you know, I remember all of that. And but I kind of did like fall away from it a little bit in college. Like I followed it all the time, but like I couldn't watch the games. And there's like a completely different level when you can't really watch the games. It's like hard to stay like connected to it. And my college years were 09 to 13. So like during those years, I kind of was like slightly
you didn't miss anything.
Yeah, I know. I have heard. The 09 World Series was hell for me because I went to the University of Delaware for my undergraduate, and that's very much Phillies country. And but there's also a lot of New York, New Jersey area transplants who mostly are Yankees fans, just because of the sheer statistical numbers of it. And so like the 09 World Series being Phillies versus Yankees was just, it was a living nightmare. I like locked myself in my dorm for a week. I remember I was like, I'm just pretending this isn't happening. Nope, not happening. Nope. I refuse to go outside. But yeah, so those were my college years, and I was kind of tuned out for the Mets for a little bit, even though I was like following them, but they were bad, and so I wasn't really watching the games every day. But then, you know, in grad school, I moved away from home, and it came back full force, and that's when, like, even though I didn't have other Mets fans near me in my everyday life anymore, that's when I found Amazing Avenue, that's when I started, like, you know, following, like, this online community, and, you know, I'm back and better than ever, so more invested than ever, so that's kind of my story and where I came to be where I am now. So yeah, those are our Mets origin stories. Thank you so much to David. I think it was David, right, who asked us that on Twitter?
Yes.
Yep. So thank you, David, for sending that in. It's always really good to like reminisce about times past and our Mets origin stories. So finally, to close things out for this week, we're going to do walk-off wins like we do every week, where each of us talks about what's making us happy this week, baseball related or otherwise. So Maggie, what is your walk-off win for this week?
My walk-off win is that I am now officially an aunt twice over. My sister-in-law and her husband welcomed their second baby, Alma, and we met her this weekend, and she's lovely, as most, like, one-week-old babies are. And yeah, it's just they're a great family. We love going to games together. She is in line for many adorable hand-me-down toddler-sized jerseys. And yeah, so welcome baby Alma to the world, and welcome to being a Mets fan.
That's fantastic. Welcome, baby Alma. Yay.
Yes. Yay.
Linda, what is your walk-off win for this week?
My walk-off win is Saturday's game. I went to the game on Saturday. This was not my first game. This was my third game of the year that I've been to. And it was a nice night. I mean, it did rain later on, but it wasn't like awful, awful rain. It was just little sprinkles. It did start coming down later, but it wasn't like you could sit through it. But we got there early enough. I went into the Mets Hall of Fame. I got to see Jake's Cy Young Award, which looks good. It's all fixed. I can vouch for it being fixed after it got chipped in the offseason.
Hashtag Mets.
Yeah, of course. He has his own little corner with his jersey and with the Cy Young Award. And then, you know, I got to see some other cool stuff in there. They have a lot of 69 stuff out. They have the, you know, the World Series trophies in there. They have a lot of Mike Piazza stuff in there. They have the first ever ball thrown in Mets history there. So if you haven't been to the Mets Hall of Fame, I recommend it. They have a lot of cool stuff in there, and it really wasn't too crowded, so you can actually like look and see everything if you get there early enough before the game. And then as for the game itself, we had good Jake.
Yay.
Yeah, and I think even Laura Albanese tweeted when he gave up a hit, the crowd visibly groaned because he was so good early on. It was, you have that little thing in the back of your head, like maybe it's today the day. So, but he did, he looked really good. And, you know, this was my first Jake start that I've seen this year. And, you know, and then I got to see my first Pete ever, my first Pete Alonso home run, which I was so, and I even got a picture of it. Cause I just snapped it when he swung and hoped, and I actually got it. And then I was, you know, Conforto went back to back. So it's games like that. Like, you know, it was a hard week with all, you know, the Addison Russell stuff. And so it's sometimes it's hard loving a sport or a game that doesn't love you back. But then it's you get magical games like that, and where you're like, okay, you know, all's good for at least today. Like, you know, it was just the perfect day to kind of like rekindle my love for the sport. And then like, even when you go to the game, like you see little things like Neil Walker got on base. And when, you know, Jake was out of the inning, he was trying to get Walker's attention. He finally did. And, you know, I saw Walker look up and like, he kind of pointed and laughed at Jake. So like, just like little interactions like that, that you wouldn't get on TV. And Grandy came up to bat. We got to cheer Grandy. I still miss and love Grandy so much. And so, you know, it was just, then the rain had stopped just in time for the fireworks. They got the fireworks in. And then as soon as the fireworks were over, it started raining again. So it was like the perfect window.
And it never stopped ever again.
Yeah, and now
it hasn't stopped since.
No, I think it has, actually. So that was my walk-off win. Just a good night at the Citi Field ballpark.
And that kind of goes back to what we were saying at the top of the show regarding Jake getting things back together again and like feeling, you know, feeling good about Jake and that feeling that you talked about of like, ooh, is this the night? Like, that's what all of 2018 felt like. Every single start, it was like, can't miss because you were like, if I miss it, I might miss a no-hitter. And so,
yeah,
like,
I might miss something magical, yeah.
Exactly. So having that feeling back about Jacob deGrom, oh, there's nothing like it. Like, that's just, even that alone, even if, like, other things continue to go poorly for the Mets, having that feeling back would be really awesome. Just, like, going into every Jake start thinking, like, is this the night? Is this the night? So my walk-off win for this week is when I gave my thesis defense back in February. My really close group of college friends, whom I love dearly, pooled their resources and got me the best graduation gift ever, which was two tickets to see Come From Away on Broadway on Mother's Day weekend with my mom. So that was awesome. So obviously Mother's Day weekend was this past weekend. So my mom and I went to the city on Saturday, the day before actual Mother's Day, and spent the day together. We went to Bryant Park, and there was a craft fair happening in Bryant Park, and we just like strolled around, looked at all the stuff, drank some fancy lemonade, some fancy overpriced lemonade, very New York. you know, ate some food, looked at all the like independent art happening in the city, which was really cool. And then we ate dinner at a little pub, and then we went to see the show, and the show was phenomenal. So that's why it's my walk-off win this week, because the show was amazing. I knew I was going to love it, even going in, because I was like, oh, this sounds like exactly up my alley. But I have a thing where I really, really try not to listen to the soundtrack beforehand. I think the only show that I've ever listened to the soundtrack before I saw the show was Hamilton, because it's kind of like, I kind of fell out of the loop at that point, like, kind of had to listen to Hamilton. But I didn't hear the soundtrack beforehand, and it was so amazing. For those of you that aren't familiar with Come From Away, to give a very non-spoilery type of synopsis, it's based on a true story, so it's hard to have spoilers because it's, you know, historical. But it's about this tiny town in Newfoundland, Canada, that's right next to the Newfoundland airport. And in the aftermath of 9/11, obviously all of the planes were grounded and American airspace was closed because of the terrorist attack. And so this little town in Canada suddenly had to deal with all of these planes full of people that were grounded in their tiny airport, and the population of the town doubled overnight. It's just about this tiny town taking in all of these essentially like refugees from all over the world flying to all sorts of destinations that were grounded in Newfoundland, Canada. And it's kind of like, you know, there are parts of it that are sad, obviously, because it's, you know, the events surrounding 9/11 and everything having to do with that. But mostly it's just a really happy show because it's about, you know, the power of human compassion and this tiny town banding together with what little resources they had to house all these people and all these people, you know, sharing this really tough experience together, but forming bonds that can never be broken as a result of that. So it's a really emotional, really, really good show. Highly recommend if you have the opportunity to see it, to go see it. But, you know, like a lot of Broadway plays, it's like impossible to get tickets to it. You know, I got these tickets a long time ago and I'm finally going to see it. And so I'm really really, really grateful for my friends for getting me this such a fantastic graduation gift, and even more grateful that I got to share it with my mom on Mother's Day. So that is my walk-off win for this week. So that does it for this week's show. Join us next Wednesday for another edition of A Pod of Their Own. In the meantime, you can go to AmazingAvenue.com, look for all of our fantastic content. Like Maggie alluded to, she is dropping a Rosario piece pretty soon about Rosario's renaissance and how he's looked pretty good lately. So keep looking for that and all of our game recaps and news posts and all of our regular content. You can follow Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can follow our show on Twitter at A Pod of Their Own. You can follow me on Twitter. I am at Petite PhD. Where are you, Linda?
I am at Linda Surovich.
And you, Maggie?
At Maggie162.
You can follow all of us on Twitter, follow the show. If you want to be featured on one of our mailbag segments, on one of our seventh inning stretch segments, you can email the show aa.apodoftheirown@gmail.com. So be sure to shoot us an email if you want to be featured on one of these segments in the future. Original music in the intro and outro to this podcast is by Bunga. Let's go Mets. And don't forget, there is no crying in podcasts.